to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, and I'm being joined today by Jeremy, who you've heard before on the show many times before, coming from the Bigger Than the Game podcast. But today he's with his co-host of the Pop Culture 5 podcast. This is Thomas. And gentlemen, welcome to Everything is a Primary Source. Welcome back, Jeremy. And Thomas, welcome for the first time.
Yeah, thank you, Eric.
So we were talking before we hit record about your new podcast. And I know, Jeremy, we met because we did one about sports through, you know, that's how we connected. But you met Thomas because you did, Thomas, you have another podcast about SNL.
Yeah. So I co-host the SNL Hall of Fame podcast. So the conceit is we have different nominees and different categories for basically the SNL Hall of Fame that we created, that my co-host Jamie Du created. So I lead the conversations for that. Jeremy reached out. He was a listener. He's a fan of SNL. And he reached out with an idea about a potential episode, which ended up being Dick Ebersol. So we did an episode on Dick Ebersol. Jeremy was my guest. He was great. Jeremy's an awesome podcaster. I like to say when he reached out, I did vet him. I listened to Bigger Than the Game just to kind of get Jeremy's vibe and see. And so when he was a guest on SNL Hall of Fame, we just really clicked. We had like a really nice rapport in the show. It went really smoothly. And then we just kind of started talking. Both of us wanted to venture out to talk general pop culture. So we decided, you know, the wheels started kind of getting in motion. We brainstorming, and then Pop Culture 5 happened. We found the way in, essentially, to talk about the pop culture that we love.
It's a delightful show, and I like the game show style aspect to it, of Pop Culture 5, of being able to, as a listener, trying to see where you line up with the two hosts and your selections of things. And I encourage everybody to listen to that one. And I think that the SNL show is, you tell me, this might actually come up with what we're talking about today. So our topic for today is This Is Spinal Tap. And the stars of this movie were on the 84-85 season. They had a one-year contract on SNL. And sometimes people think that the Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, Billy Crystal years are not necessarily the highest point for SNL. Would you agree with that, or do you think there's some hidden gems in that era?
I think that's a good season. Actually, that was the final Dick Ebersol season. Martin Short was part of that cast as well. You had Jim Belushi, who I think is kind of an underrated SNL cast member. I think Jim Belushi, not John Belushi, Jim Belushi did a lot of really good stuff on SNL. But I think that was a pretty good season, but maybe lost steam there toward the end. If you read Martin Short's bio, he admits that it sort of lost steam at the end. I think Martin Short was like, yeah, I did a few shows and then I realized that I had to do more and kind of lost steam. But there was a lot of gems in that. Synchronized Swimming is a very well-known sketch with Christopher Guest and Martin Short, Harry Shearer. Harry Shearer, that was actually a second stint on SNL. He was at the tail end of the original series. So what do you think, Jeremy, that the Martin Short, Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest season? What do you think of that one?
I think I agree with you. It's a very strong season. I think because Dick Ebersol, he called that his Steinbrenner year, where he just went out and got established stars. People kind of scoff at it because I think a big part of SNL is we get to see these stars on the up and up, and we like kind of feel like we discovered them. We knew them before they were these big comedic superstars. And for that year, these guys had already done things. Billy Crystal had already been on Soap. You know, like you said, Harry Shearer had been on before. These guys were kind of known. So it kind of takes away that discovery. But I think for that one year, it's one of the better seasons in SNL history.
And we also saw Julia Louis-Dreyfus in that season, too. So we saw an up-and-comer that season.
We're talking like 7 years of SNL by the time the 84 season comes around, right? It's like,
yeah, this was season, I want to say season 10.
Okay,
yeah.
So they've been at it. And I wonder if they were trying to do inventive things, too, by taking some veterans of comedy and saying, all right, how would you do with live, sometimes quasi improvisational style humor, sketch comedy versus a scripted program. Like, let's see how you do with this. And of course they went back to the original style of SNL, but that it was, I suppose 84. Yeah, that was a lot of trying new things. And you know, that matches up in SNL. It matches up in This Is Spinal Tap. So let's dive into it. They were going to make it a scripted movie, but not even starting filming it, they said, we can't do that. The strength of this movie, it was almost 100% improvised. I mean, could you imagine doing that?
The genius of the cast, but also the genius of Rob Reiner, and really this being like his directorial debut. And we know how great of a director Rob Reiner has become, but just kind of knowing that, the genius of it is like that initial reaction. This movie is just great for the reactions from people. Like the lines are great, but then keeping that camera on like who's in the scene, who's in the frame, and just watching their reactions. And, you know, Eric, we rewatched this. I've seen it before, but, you know, getting ready for this week's episode with you, I rewatched it again and just how amazing it looks. Like it's just for, you know, in the early 80s, it still just holds up on how great of a documentary it looks like. And I understand now why so many people were confused thinking like, oh, this is a real band, because it just looks amazing.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny too, because the studio really wanted a scripted, because that's what they were used to. They were used to a scripted sort of narrative. So they actually gave the principal players, I think, each like $10,000 or something like that. So the studio gave them a lump sum of money at the beginning to go write a script. But what happened was they actually filmed a 20-minute short and then as a proof of concept for the studio, saying this is going to work. I don't even know if they told the studio that it was improv until the studio gave them feedback and they liked it. And I was like, okay, well, we did it improv. So, and then they kept a lot of the same beats, so some of the same lines that they kind of reused. But it was a 20-minute short, which you can find, and it's really well done. So that's how it was made. But I think the principal players were like, you know, this will be fun if it's improv. We have the skills. That's our skill set. We have the background. Let's try it this way. So that's what I find fascinating right there, is like they kind of went against what the studio wanted and did this proof of concept, this 20-minute proof of concept first.
It's very fitting, I think, for the era, because there was a lot of DIY going on back then. A lot of younger creative types saying, you know, I want to try things my own way. I'm going to do things my own way. And thankfully having people willing to take the risk on it. So Norman Lear put up a lot of money for This Is Spinal Tap, and he liked the idea. And I think that's pretty fitting for him, because, you know, with his track record in television, he was all about realism. Right. He, you know, All in the Family was his, the Jeffersons and, you know, other programs. He made 70s TV basically by being like a reflection in a mirror. And so it totally makes sense that he would understand the ultimate in parody, which is paper thin, you know, difference from reality to what we see. And so it's like that can only happen if you have this inventive new way of making a film of like, all right, we're going to know the beginning and end of the scene. We know like how we have to move the story along, but we're going to use these talents of these not only funny comedians, but talented musicians to, and then go ahead to have fun, play a game. And so I understand they made something like, you know, hundreds of hours of recordings just to, so they could piece together some kind of story to it.
Well, to your point on Norman Lear, the connection, you know, Rob Reiner was on All in the Family, you know, played Mike Stivic. And Rob Reiner was looking for someone to put up money to help back this. And because he kind of wanted to do this on his own, he didn't want to ask Norman Lear. And they have a close relationship. But because of, like you said, Eric, like how different this was, no one wanted to back this. So then it became like he went to Norman Lear, and to Norman's credit, the late, great Norman Lear, he said, I trust you, I believe in you. And he wound up putting up that money. So it takes that kind of sponsorship. And like you said, from someone who was a revolutionary and someone who thought outside the box to believe in these guys, to have This Is Spinal Tap, you know, go into production.
It's funny to me that given how progressive and forward thinking and visionary this movie was, the subject matter is a washed up, tired old band that can't seem to decide what their next step should be. And, you know, how their creative vision is going to, you know, they're just like relying on, you know, the previous 10 years for hope that somebody's going to remember them in the future. And so it's just so funny that they made it that way. I think that's hilarious. And that kind of brings us to the next question is, what material is this made from? And so Spinal Tap, first of all, I got to say, in fake band names in TV and movies, it's probably one of the better ones. You know, like you one time sometimes watch TV shows and they're like, yeah, my friends are playing tonight. What's their band name? Like, oh, they're the Hairy Armpits, or, you know, like ridiculous names that nobody could possibly, but like Spinal Tap sounds like a legit band. And in some ways they kind of were, because Michael McKean and Christopher Guest, and I think Shearer was part of that too, had done a sketch comedy show where they performed as this fake British hard rock band called Spinal Tap. And so there's something. They didn't invent the group just for the movie. But just in general, where do you think that they were getting a lot of their motifs from when it came to that rock star kind of persona?
I think Christopher Guest, I love this. He got the inspiration of this whole kind of band dynamic and this band. So Christopher Guest was at a hotel. He said back in the early 70s, like in 1974, he saw an English band checking into the hotel, and he witnessed a conversation between one of the band members and their manager. And the band member said that he didn't know where his bass was. He's like, I lost my bass. And the manager said, where is it? You lost your bass? He's like, I must've left it at the airport. So Christopher Guest said he was witnessing this ridiculous conversation about this bass player from this band leaving his bass at the airport. And he said the conversation went on for like 15 minutes. So like that's like the kernel, and that's all you need, like, is a comedian. That's like the kernel of the idea. And then they're taking inspiration from like Led Zeppelin, I think, was maybe a big inspiration in the 70s. The Stonehenge thing happened to a certain extent. I think it happened in reverse with Black Sabbath, with Ozzy. They had a Stonehenge that was too big and they couldn't fit it. But I think that may have happened. That might have been just a coincidence. But I know Led Zeppelin was a big inspiration. It was kind of just a amalgamation of just all these bands. That's why it felt so personal to all these bands. Because some of them were convinced, oh, they're making fun of us. Like, well, in a way they are. I mean, not specifically you, but like the idea of you and your band and some of the ridiculous things. So I think it's, you could say Led Zeppelin, you could say this random English band that Christopher Guest saw, but I just think the culture in general was just ripe for that in the 70s.
And there were some rock documentaries like the Don't Look Back, The Last Waltz, yep. You know, Don't Look Back about Bob Dylan, The Last Waltz about the band. So like there were some rock documentaries that had come out, and I think they're pretty good, honestly, like looking back on them. But I think that's also like a little bit of that influence of how it was made, of like we've seen kind of the template of these rock documentaries, so we can use that. To what Thomas said, like that reputation of what like rock and roll is, and, you know, the Who, you know, and all those groups like just creating havoc on tour. We can kind of use that stereotype, or if it is a stereotype back then, and kind of just play with it.
Well, and that's whenever I listen to Spinal Tap, I have the soundtrack, which is also an album from, and I've listened to it before, and it's hard to put a finger on exactly either the band or the genre that they're really like needling throughout it, you know, but I guess the closest would be, you know, because you think about groups like The Who, which started in the mid 60s, and by the 80s they're still making music, but it sounds tremendously different from what they were doing in the 60s. And then even more so Led Zeppelin with, you know, the Yardbirds is like the Thamesmen. you know, and then they changed their name, Led Zeppelin, Spinal Tap, and they turned into a hard rock group. And this is almost as if, you know, that, like you said, that culture is extending into a time that's really not welcoming to them. You know, early 80s is not really the best time for these kinds of, because they're not quite hair metal bands. Like, it's not quite that glamour rock of Poison and those kind of groups. They're just, you know, hard rockers from the 70s that never adjusted to the changing times.
Yeah, I always saw them as a like Black Sabbath almost. But then we were saying at the beginning of this podcast, like, oh, there was the band was trying to figure out where they were going to go next. I think the marketplace was figuring out for them where they were going to go next. Like, it was this band that was stuck in the 70s and probably we're in what, 83, 84. And this movie's happening in real time. So this movie is supposed to be happening in like 83, 84.
Yeah.
And
it's the 82 fall tour.
That's, okay. It's the 82 yeah. fall tour. Yeah, yeah. So music's like already changing. So you think about like 82. Like, what's the biggest album of 82? Like, Thriller came out in 82, right? So that, like, the like music's kind of shifting that yeah, way no. away from
MTV the old came out in 81.
MTV, yeah. So music's kind of shifting away from kind of the old hard rock, Black Sabbath-y type bands. Even Ozzy is incorporating a little different elements starting in the 80s. So the marketplace is deciding for this band that you're going to be left behind because the music culture is changing and they just don't know how to adjust to that. And that's mm-hmm. ripe for comedy.
It
right
is
there.
It's perfect. And there's even more to like the cars, you know, like those new wave acts were really starting to pick up. And the scene late in Spinal Tap where they play at the Air Force Base, I think, and first of all, that is, I grew up on an Air Force Base. We did go to things like that. They would have once a month or so, like they design, like they we'd go to a hangar and they would have live music and dancing and it was just like a, you know, R&R type thing. But the base that I grew up on, I didn't know this until just recently, but the group The Cars, because they're from Boston and we're just north of Boston, they played their very first concert at Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, one of those kinds of things. Okay. So I'm kind of curious, and that was like 1978 and 79, so I wouldn't be surprised if that also is why it wasn't like an original idea of playing Air Force Base, you know, for this band. That's like one of the funniest parts of that movie is when,
yeah,
you know, the box that he has for his guitar starts getting scrambled up. I have to ask you guys, what do you think about the introduction with, you know, with Rob Reiner as Marty DeBurgi doing the introduction? Do you, because they don't do that for any of the other mockumentaries, Best in mm-hmm. Show, A Mighty Wind, which also has Spinal Tap in it as the Folksman, and Waiting for Guffman. They don't start it off with, hi, I'm the director of this movie you're about to watch and I'm calling it a rockumentary. I mean, do you think that that's, was that necessary to do just to introduce the style of filmmaking, or would it have been as strong if they just launched right into the This Is Spinal Tap?
For me, I think I see where you're coming from, and I think it would have been interesting if they just would have went into it, but I loved it. I think Rob Reiner sets the tone, and how he does it, it's hilarious. Like, you know, like that straight face, but, you know, even how he compliments like the band just kind of cracks me up. I forget, he said they brought intensity, like power, and I forget the third thing. It was like being prompt punctuality. And like that kind of humor, like where if you're watching it, it kind of hits you. You're like, huh? And it, you kind of like catch up to the joke later. I just think the way he did it nailed it. And I feel like for that particular, I see like for the future, you couldn't do that a lot. But for that movie and for this being so inventive, I think it was necessary to kind of set the tone of this is what this movie's going to be like.
And I think they had there was a luxury that they had that the actual director of This Is Spinal Tap was a good performer and he could pull that off. And so like might as well. I think that's a really funny meta kind of thing to have the director of This Is Spinal Tap play Marty, the director of this documentary about Spinal Tap. So we get into a fun meta thing right away. I think it was a nod too to possibly like Marty Scorsese.
All of them.
yeah, like the from the last waltz. I think Rob Reiner even said like he noticed that Martin Scorsese kind of put himself into the last waltz a little bit. So that kind of gave him the idea to maybe I should put myself more into this documentary, into this movie. But the fact that Rob Reiner is such a capable performer, I think it works. I think the movie would have worked anyway, but it's just a nice, like, perfect cherry on top for me to see Rob Reiner do that.
And his name is an homage to, because Marty Scorsese and then Berg, like Steven Spielberg, Brian De Palma. Yeah. So like, it's kind of like all those great directors who kind of put their names together.
In a way, I guess it makes it for like the crossroads of comedy and filmmaking and all that stuff being marked with that moment in that film, because you have, like you just said, that whole crew of the new Hollywood directors from the late 60s, early 70s, of the Scorseses and De Palmas and Spielberg and Lucas, and even Mel Brooks is sometimes put into that category. And of course, his work with Carl Reiner, you know, Rob's son, it's like, and then that, and Rob is kind of like the extension of that into this new era. And so he's bringing with him, you know, by name, Marty DeBerge. And now we'll never have to do this again, but I'm just kind of trying to connect time periods where this is the crossroads. This is how comedy is going to be, or at least this will be another option for comedy going forward, that if you want to tell a story, because there have been other mockumentaries. There's one called Drop Dead Gorgeous that was, in my opinion, drop dead awful. It broke all those rules. Like, they immediately just threw out, like, you know, getting shots of things that crew wouldn't have access to, you know, multiple angles. Anyway, it's just bad. But it was like, now here's an option. You know, if you want to tell a satirical parody story, but you don't want it to be obviously a comedy with a laugh track in a TV show, or having, you know, total over the top, you know, slapsticky type stuff, make it like a documentary. You know, people are familiar with these now.
I think it's rewarding as a comedy fan and viewer if I see a subtle piece of comedy, and mockumentaries lend themselves to being subtle. So you have to really pay attention. Like, but this is Spinal Tap, probably my favorite comedy of all time, but it's one where you can't sit on your phone and scroll Twitter and do all kinds of, like, you really need to pay attention to the jokes, and mockumentary style lends itself. It's very rewarding in that sense. Like, you watch it again. I watch episodes of The Office and I pick up on little nuances of delivery, because they have to, because in a mockumentary, the people on screen aren't supposed to be quote unquote performers. They're not really supposed to be performing. They're just supposed to be depicting real people. So you can't overplay it in a mockumentary. So I like that about it. I like that reward as a comedy fan, that I picked up on this joke. I picked up on Nigel and David forming a band called The Originals, but then there was another band called The Originals, so they had to change their name to The New Originals. Like, they kind of just play through it. Nigel and David aren't performers. They're just telling a real story that happened to them, but it's a funny story. So as a viewer, I have to really pay attention, but having to pay that much attention and getting the subtle jokes is that much more rewarding. That's a big reason why I love mockumentaries, and specifically how Christopher Guest does mockumentaries, to your point.
It's especially knowing that they're improvising the whole thing, mm-hmm. and you can watch them, and it's like, just, you know, split second reaction time from them. Like, when they're talking about later on, like, oh, you know, that project we always wanted to work on about Jack the Ripper.
Do you remember what we were, do you remember the
at
project?
At the Luton Palace, we were talking about a rock musical based on the life of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, right. Saucy Jack.
Saucy Jack. Now is the time to do
you're
that.
You're a naughty one.
Saucy Jack.
You're a haughty one. Saucy Jack.
Right.
It's a freeing up, isn't it?
And then they start writing a song. I'm like, I think they just, how quick-witted all of those actors were, that they were able just to bounce back and forth. And like you said, create that whole story early in the film about the new originals. And, you know, then they called themselves the regulars. And, you know, it's just, it's like you said, rewarding, and also just like a marvel to watch how good they are at that kind of thing.
in the shows, you have to have that improv background. You have to be able to always say yes, always go on with the story. Like, it, you know, even like if you're a great stand-up, you couldn't really do that in this movie because it's working with others, but always just, all right, I throw out something crazy and, you know, Eric, you got to match it. And then Thomas, you got to match that. Like, if you don't have that background and especially and be great at it, it's really hard to pull this kind of movie off.
Yeah, you look at the people who Christopher Guest chooses, the main people who he liked to work with after this, Jeremy, you're right. They all had improv backgrounds. They all had sketch backgrounds. Like in Best in Show, Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, Jennifer Coolidge, Jane Lynch, all those people. Michael McKean was brought back for Best in Show. Like everybody in this movie basically was vetted by Christopher Guest as being comfortable with improv and sketch and things of that nature. So it's about choosing the right people to do this too. You can't just pull in anybody and say, hey, let's come do some improv. Like somebody might be good at it. I might ask Brad Pitt to come do improv and he might be good at it, but Christopher Guest and Rob Reiner and those people, they know the stable of folks that they trust. So you got to get good people with those types of backgrounds to do this type of work. And you're going to get magic a lot of times when you get the right people.
And there was a training ground for all of this in the years leading up to This Is Spinal Tap. You had the Groundlings out in LA. You had Second City. You had a lot of these improv groups in college campuses and just springing up everywhere where you're right. There are some people who can do stand up and improv, but then there's plenty who can't do both. You know, it's like improv, that working off each other, being like, you have such a wealth of knowledge. You have such a wealth of characters that you could just be tossed a prop and just go with it and create a whole story right there. And then, you know, these kinds of films, and Spinal Tap being the first one, is just like the, you know, it's just the result of all these years of training that and mm-hmm. practice that these people had. And, you know, I think we covered, actually, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the maker's role and status in society. But we already kind of did that already with at least Rob Reiner. And let's talk just briefly about some of the other people in there. You know, we have Michael McKean, who had become part of, you know, America's Households with Laverne and Shirley, you know, and had done some sketch comedy things. And Harry Shearer, who just was kind of present but never really in the forefront of a lot of things. He's even in Star Wars. He provides a voice of, yeah, at least a voice, if he's not one of the guys that goes on to the Millennium Falcon to scan when it's in the Death Star. Like, that's him. And Christopher Guest, which out of all of them, he's the only one that's in the House of Lords in, you know, Great Britain. Like, he's a baron. And so it's like, but either they themselves or guys like that, you know, in that era, where would you put them on kind of like status in show business?
Gosh, well, by 1984, they were in the comedy world, seemed like they were in that middle ground because they weren't, none of them were Steve Martin. So I'd say 84, you had Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, were probably like the kings of comedy, maybe around that time. I'm sure I'm forgetting something.
Bill Murray,
absolutely. Yeah. Those were the guys, Dan Aykroyd. So none of them were on that level, but they were in that middle ground where those guys, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, they knew about Christopher Guest. They knew about Harry Shearer. So they were respected by the upper echelon. I would be remiss if I didn't mention National Lampoon as another training ground. So yeah, so Christopher Guest was part of like the National Lampoon Radio Hour that birthed damn near half the original cast of SNL came from, like that National Lampoon Radio Hour. So Christopher Guest in particular was known for his sketch and improv chops back at National Lampoon. Tony Hendra, who played Ian in the movie, was one of the original writers when National Lampoon was founded by Doug Kenny and them. Tony Hendra was one of the original writers. He became an editor the second year that the National Lampoon existed. So he was another one who was not known in the general consciousness, but the main players in comedy knew Tony Hendra. They knew Christopher Guest, and they, because they came from a place like National Lampoon where you had to be witty and clever, and people like Steve Martin and Chevy Chase and Bill Murray respected people like Christopher Guest and Tony Hendra and Harry Shearer. So I would say that they were like in that comfortable middle ground of respectability, but not stardom around that time.
And for me, I agree with Thomas. And I think it's by choice that Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, they chased movie stardom and being in the system. Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, Michael McKean, they didn't want to really be in the machine. They loved to perform and create, but they wanted to, like Thomas said earlier, work with who they wanted to work with and didn't want the studio Hollywood types kind of interfering. They wanted their freedom to create, and they weren't really about getting the dollars box office wise or being like the highest paid actor. Because like, it's not because of talent that these guys weren't with Bill Murray and Chevy Chase. Like, they could have been there. They just chose to go a different way. And even, especially Harry Shearer, kind of already had reputations of being quote unquote difficult. Yeah. Some may say it's warranted, some not, but like, they kind of wanted to do it their own way.
Witnesses at the new birth of Spinal Tap Mark II. Hope you enjoy our new direction.
It's a show busy type movie, and I love those. For the record, I like behind the scenes type stuff. One of my favorite movies of all time is That Thing You Do, which shows a band, you know, kind of come together and then, you know, rapid rise to stardom. And you get to see, you know, backstage, you get to see before the show and after the show and stuff like that. Do you think that the music industry itself was one of the target audiences of This Is Spinal Tap?
I think it was meant to be funny, like, but the music industry didn't think it was funny because it kind of hit too close to home. But I think it was meant to like be laughed at. I think it was intended for them to be a part of it and laugh at it. But because of how well it was done and how close to home it hit, a lot of people were like, you know, didn't find it funny. A lot of like great like rock bands were like, it wasn't funny to them because, as we've been saying, a lot of these stories are kind of based on some truth to somebody. So it was intended, I believe, but it didn't wind up not being intended for them.
Yeah, I think part of the draw was that if you're into music, if you're into rock music, then I think you'll enjoy this. If you're into documentaries even, then I think you'll enjoy this. So I think that was probably part of the hook. They're probably picturing like, well, music fans would probably be interested in something like this, especially if somebody enjoyed like The Last Waltz or something like that. They might be a target audience. But I think the sensibility of the movie was intended maybe more so for somebody who would go read the National Lampoon magazine or watch the early days of SNL. I think it was the sensibility of it is intended for those comedy nerds that maybe have more like highbrow, sophisticated comedy sensibilities. But part of the marketing of the movie was, hey, if you like music and documentaries, this could be something that you want to see. So that was part of like, I think the genius of the material was that it was wrapped a certain way to draw a lot of people in, and it was rewarding for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, I think a music fan would really appreciate it because they have, it's like, yeah, that's the reason I leave bands like this behind is because they're awful on and off the stage. Like, they're just, you know, tired and boring. And I remember reading a interview with Glenn Danzig, actually, of the Misfits and Danzig and, you know, all these other groups. But, you know, that movie came out while he was in the Misfits. And he said, I went and saw Spinal Tap. This Is Spinal Tap. And especially the part where they get lost backstage. He's like, that was my band. He's like, I'm looking at my guys in this. And he's like, that was the moment that I realized that other people realized the dysfunction of those kinds of groups. He's like, that's when he decided he had to move on from
I love Misfits. The visual of the Misfits in particular, yeah. Getting lost backstage with their just these muscly guys with like makeup and look, just yeah. like yeah zombie makeup and running around and like getting lost, like that is, the Misfits in particular getting lost is a really fun visual.
Viewers of it, and you also kind of see in that the part with Paul Schaefer shows up as the promoter, you know, the marketing guy for Polymer, which I love the name of that record company, you know, Dentures. They go to this record store and there's nobody in the record store, not just because Spinal Tap is there and they're trying to avoid them, but because that kind of like independent record store was really under threat in the early 80s. You know, the bigger mall record stores, you know, they even mention early in the film, Sears and Kmart refused to carry your records. Like, I remember my brother buying, you know, tapes and stuff from Sears, you know, like they still had, you know, it was very, you know, those places were catering to the casual music fan, you know, and the real music fans, the very people who are loving every bit of this movie because it's so funny, are also the ones who would be going to a record store that, as this film shows in 1982-83, is not very well attended anymore.
No, that's a good point, because in the 70s, especially the late 70s, the music industry starts to take a downward spiral and it's not booming as much. So that's why those record stores are going away. And then with MTV coming of age and, you know, Michael Jackson and Thriller and all those things, it's taking a boom, but we're going into that visual kind of way. And we're trying to get that, you know, that consumer who would watch MTV and would buy those records. So that's where it is. Like, they're going to those, you know, a Sears or a Kmart or a Walmart to try to get those records.
Like ultra commercialized and, you know, where other forms of media were on the flip side of that, like comic book stores, that's when they were first coming up, you know, because for a while, the only place you get your comics would be like drugstores and grocery stores at the checkout counter. But in 83-84, there's actual independent comic book stores opening up, and that's where kids are flocking to get like expert, you know, opinion, like here's what you should. And then, and same thing with like video stores and stuff like that. Which is also part of the story of where Spinal Tap got a cult following, is, you know, didn't do great in the theater, but it's perfect for VHS world.
These are a new direction.
Got a new idea for a new
presentation. The stage look of the band, fashioned after the signs of the Zodiac.
We needed a new presentation.
This is a look for Viv. He's a Libra. There's the sort of the yin, yang, look. This is Nigel. He's Capricorn. Sort of a goat look.
Give you a little beard.
This is a joke.
This is a joke.
Do you think it was made in that time as a way just to kind of recognize how rapidly pop music was changing in 84?
Yeah, I'm surprised that we've gone this long. And correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if any of us, the three of us, have said the word satire once in this podcast. But that, I mean, it's a satire of the music industry. It's a satire of bands from around that time. I mean, I think that's you're right in asking that question, Eric. I think that's a lot of the reason why they made it is to just poke fun a little bit at the changing times, at the types of bands that just will not evolve for better or worse. At the music industry, at the A&R people, who are the ones telling them, like, Sears and Kmart are boycotting the album, and we have an idea. Look at this album cover; it's all black. And so I think it's just a wonderful satire, and I think that's by design. I think they may have been looking at the shift in music and everything like that, and it was just in capable hands to do a satire. But I think that is a big reason probably why they made this, is because they just saw something glaring in something that they love, because these are all music fans. So they probably saw something glaring in music, something that they love, and say, this is ripe for satire. And we're capable, and so we know how to satirize this.
No, I think that's a great point. I think you're right that it was satire, and it, you know, to me, a lot of, not all, but a lot of great comedy is reflecting, showing what's happening at this time. And I think that's what, if you look throughout the history of comedy, that's what it's doing. Whether you're on stage as a stand-up comic, or, you know, a comedy album, or TV, movies, whatever the case, it's showing what's going on. And this movie is a great time capsule of showing where the music industry was kind of transforming in the early 80s. What I love about this is, same with The Simpsons or SNL, when they're really great, you can look, you know, when SNL does a great political sketch, it's like it's poking fun at both sides. So a Republican thinks, hey, they got the Democrats. Democrat think they got the Republican. The Simpsons do that well, as in my opinion. And this movie does it, where if I'm a band in the early 80s, like a younger up and coming band, I can be like, oh, they're making fun of those older bands from back in the day. If I'm an older band, I could be like, oh, yeah, they're making fun of these newer bands. And then you can also say, yeah, they're making fun of these executives and how they don't know anything and they're trying to change it and all that stuff. You can really look at all sides that they're really doing a great job of doing that satire.
We had to apologize for him with our set.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. People were still booing him.
It's all hard.
Yep, we got our rights. Big, fat, sweet. Yeah. What? Have you seen Duke Fame's current album?
Yes.
Seen the cover.
The last question I want to bring up is, where was it made and what locations are associated with it? And so I didn't know this until just now. I was looking it up. The whole thing was filmed in LA, greater Los Angeles. And I was actually paying close attention to the limousine scene to see if the background gave it away as not New York, you know, because you have Bruno Kirby driving the limo. And, you know, he's talking about Frank and, you know, it's going on, you know, ultimate New York stuff. But then I'm like, and for the longest time, because of that, I'm like, oh, they're driving through Manhattan, you know. But then I looked in the background, I'm like, they carefully drove in places with not a lot of palm trees. But if you actually look in the back, you can tell it's not New York. It's, you know, it's not. But what part would you give each of the cities that they go to having almost like a role in the movie? Because they hit some pretty important music locations, don't they?
Well, I think it was deliberate that they're starting to play places like Chapel Hill, yeah, North Carolina. So you see like the size of the cities, or yeah, where they're getting canceled. So I think Boston, they got canceled. So they're getting canceled in these small city or these big cities like Boston.
Not a very big college town. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they reference a gig in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is this college town in North Carolina. Cleveland, of course, everybody remembers Cleveland in this movie because that's where they got lost backstage. So I think if you're charting like where they're playing and where they are on their tour, is charting, you're kind of charting their downfall, and where, what city they're in at the time is sort of like a good visual that you have of watching this band's downfall in this tour. Yeah, so I think the different locations, even though it's all LA,
yeah,
I think them saying Cleveland, Boston, Chapel Hill, I think it's a fun thing, like you as a viewer, like we're following this band on their tour. So we know in Cleveland that this happens. We know in Boston this happens. I think that's a fun aspect of the movie.
And they packed the house in New York and Philadelphia in the first Philly two stops. Out. Yeah. And but then after that, you're right, it's like they end up playing some amusement park at one point. Jeremy, what do you make of the choices of cities? I mean, you're probably happy that Philadelphia was represented.
Of course, always.
Is Fidelity Hall, is that a real place, or what's it?
Not that I know of. Definitely not now.
Yeah,
I'm thinking about Rob Reiner at the beginning. You don't look it up now. It's not there anymore.
Yeah,
so
Electric
I'm like,
Banana.
Yeah. So I'm like, definitely not now. But I don't remember hearing a Fidelity Hall ever. So I don't think so. But I agree. It's a great point by Thomas about like tracking the downfall. I also think a little bit homage to like the history, like, you know, we know Cleveland, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, winds up being there. And then their visit to, even though it's not really Graceland, but that, you know, they're visiting Graceland and they're at Elvis's gravesite. And I think it's also like paying tribute to like the history of rock, where they're going. And like, these are cities and names that stick out with the history at the time. So I feel like that's also what they're doing.
The ending of the film, where they find out, you know, by Nigel Tufnel, who comes back after leaving, you know, a few scenes before at the Air Force base, that they're number five, they're charting number five in Japan. And then the film ends with them with a packed house in Tokyo at Kobe Hall. And they're, you know, and it's, I think, says a lot about the era before music really got globalized. You know, where we are now, where, you know, there's K-pop groups that are just as popular in America as they are in Korea. There's, you know, musicians, and American musicians have long held status around the world, but, you know, we're starting to hear more and more groups out of parts of the world that we wouldn't normally. But in those days, in the 80s, and especially Japan, was like the go-to like country that was really fast forwarding their pop culture. Like, they were, you know, really gravitating towards the United States and starting to make bonds with the United States through popular culture and stuff like that. Do you think if the movie had been made in another era, they would have chosen a different country besides Japan to say, hey, we're not famous anymore here, but now we're doing something in Japan?
I think it might have been a more obscure country, might have been a smaller country, mm-hmm. because back then, to your point, like, culture just moved slower, I think, just globally. So Spinal Tap would have maybe been popular in Japan when they were popular in the United States. It wouldn't have taken culture that long to move from the United States to Japan. Actually, Quentin Tarantino kind of depicts this in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that where Rick Dalton goes and has a good career making Westerns in Italy, because Westerns became out of fashion in the United States, but apparently they became popular in Italy. So Rick Dalton went and made movies and had a successful career. And that was in the early 70s, late 60s, or that was in the late 60s, 69. When that happened. So I think, yeah, back then culture did move slowly. So I think now it would have been some obscure small country if they'd even decided to go that route at all, because yeah, it's just what's popular here is popular in Japan. K-pop, you're right, it's popular here. So it's just about how fast culture moves now compared to 40 years ago. It's a good point.
My favorite, like I said before, one of my favorite episodes of Simpsons is when Spinal Tap, you know, shows up on it, and you see them being interviewed.
Bill and Marty here, and we're backstage rapping with a tap. Fellas, I'm going to hit you with a phrase that has dogged you throughout your career. Washed up. Yet here you are, among the top 105 concert acts today. What's your secret, guys?
Well, after the Berlin Wall fell, our records started selling on the dismal side of the Iron Curtain, and naturally that gave us a boost. We're very big in Bulgaria, and what's his name? Yadagaria? Hungaria? Yeah, whatever. I can't think of anyone who's benefited more from the death of communism than us. Well, maybe the people who actually live in the communist countries.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
I bet you're right.
Yeah, on the other hand, each of us just bought our own soccer team. How many Hungarians can say that, eh?
Because that's the one beautiful thing about the band Spinal Tap, is that they've never gone away. You know, it's like they kind of existed before this film, but then absolutely afterwards, they keep showing up. They've done tours as Spinal Tap, performances, and even more brilliant, opened by the Folksmen, which is also them. You know, they go on stage, play folk music for a while, and the audience obviously is all comedy fans. It's not, you know, actual rock and roll fans. Like, what, you know? But you know, then they do Spinal Tap, but they keep showing up. You know, in the early 90s, they had, and that's when they were on The Simpsons, they had a new album, and, you know, Break Like the Wind. And I remember seeing them as their characters improvising and like looking at modern records, and they're like, what is this one? Metallica. And it was Metallica. They, you know, they're like, what is this? And it's just like the, and when you watch the DVD of it and they do commentary as them, it's like, they still got it. You know, they know exactly mm-hmm. what's going on. And so the band, I hope, and we can end with this, I hope they are actually making a sequel right now. I think it'd be brilliant, and they're going to, I guarantee you, it's going to be fun. Now, actually, this would be perfect. Maybe not five, but between the two of you, what are some top music-related trends that would definitely show up in a Spinal Tap 2?
I would say auto-tune, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
they can maybe incorporate something with auto-tune, and they either confused by it or they really lean into it. So something like that could be fun.
I think streaming. So like they're streaming, like kind of what we were just talking about, like they're top in some obscure country, like they're streaming on Spotify, some random country, they're number like, you know, 85, but like, you know, they're kind of banking on that. So I feel like the streaming age, they'll kind of talk about that a little bit as well. I that's interesting. That's a good question though, Eric. Yeah. What?
Yeah. Or what, there might be a scene where they say like, oh, well, Derek dabbled into hip hop in the early to mid 90s. And then they do maybe flashback of Derek, yeah, like trying his hand at hip hop or something. I don't know. There's like so much has happened since 1984 in music that they could incorporate, that like, it's going to be maybe part catch-up session with the group. So that'll be fun. I kind of know, like from what I've read about the premise of the sequel, it seems really interesting. Like Ian passed away, so his widow apparently has the contract that stipulates that Spinal Tap owes them one more show. So I think that's the premise behind it, and that sounds so fun. Like I'm excited. Like I usually I'll go into it with an open mind. I don't think, if it's not good, it's not going to ruin the first one. I didn't like the Coming to America sequel, but I still like the original. So I'm just excited that they're wanting to do this. And I think it's capable hands, is what I'll say. So the prospect of this is exciting to me.
You like this?
It's very nice. It looks like Halloween.
This is my exact inner structure down in a t-shirt. Exactly medically accurate. See?
So in other words, if we were to take all your flesh and blood and every
take oil, them off,
you'd see exactly,
this is what you'd
it wouldn't
see.
Be green though.
It is green. You know, see how your blood looks blue?
Yeah, well that's just the vein. I mean the color of the vein. I mean the blood is actually red.
Oh well, maybe it's not green then, I don't know. Anyway, this is what we sleep in sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, I can't say enough for you guys. Thank you for taking the time to talk Spinal Tap, rapping with the tap, as they say in The Simpsons. And of course, you can find the program of Pop Culture Fives, everywhere that you get your podcasts, right? I'm going to be airing this episode pretty soon because the 40th anniversary of Spinal Tap is like tomorrow. So what's the next episode of your collaboration podcast all about? Are you willing to give it away?
Yeah. We have, so this week we have upcoming, we have something that we kind of came up with called a Pop Culture Blind Spot. And we did one a few weeks ago. My blind spot was Radiohead, and Thomas is a big Radiohead fan. So he kind of gave five songs for me to listen to, kind of like, you know, some homework, and then came back and was able to tell him how I felt about the group and all that stuff. So this week we have coming up, a blind spot, but we went to TV. Thomas had never seen The Big Bang Theory, and I'm a big Bang Theory fan, so he listened, he watched and kind of came back to me with what he thinks about the show. He met Kaley Cuoco, but never watched the show, so that's, you know, but it was fun to do that. And we just had our first guest on last week's episode, Erin Carlson, a great writer, and she came on to talk about essential romantic comedy movies. So it's been a lot of fun and just great episodes. And we have our back, you know, catalog for people who want to catch up. And we talk about all things pop culture and essential pop culture. So please listen.
And to show how eclectic we are, we also have upcoming five essential Metallica songs. So we went a little bit metal and talked about essential Metallica songs. And then we did a very meta episode, Five Essential Podcasts. So we did a podcast about podcasts. So that was a fun one. That was a really interesting exercise for me and Jeremy.
Absolutely.
That is a good one. And especially in the media form, as we're all demonstrating right now, that has so many moving parts and constantly people flowing into each other and stuff like that, and into each other's shows and cross-referencing.
And Eric, real quick, I'll say it on air. We want you to come on. So, you know, you have time to think about it, but think about something you want to talk about, you know, Five Essentials, and you get to come on Pop Culture Five. And,
I'm secretly, I was hoping that we would end like that, because I was like, I want to get on your show. I was like, I missed the Seinfeld one. That was a great one. I love that. But I'll definitely brainstorm some ideas and send along, because I love the setup that you have. I love the way that you do it. I think it's such a clever way of covering pop culture and, you know, just kind of allowing listeners to recognize that they're not the only ones who see it in a similar way. So thank you guys. I appreciate it. And I appreciate all of you listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including This Is Spinal Tap, is a primary source. Thanks again. Please rate and follow this podcast wherever you are listening to it right now, and share with everyone you know. You can follow the Everything is a Primary Source podcast on social media, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Show notes, which expound on each episode, and essays about history and pop culture can be found on Substack. The hub for all these things is everything-history.com. Thank you for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.
These go to 11.